It is 8:31, and we have with us live in the studios once again, John Parrish, co-editor at Eat This Steak. Good morning.
Good morning to you.
Busy week.
Really?
Well,
anything happen?
apparently, there were elections and.
Oh least, yeah, Daniel Ortega is back in power in Nicaragua. That was great.
Yeah, that was nice to finally see that.
Yes,
but there was also elections in this country. Apparently, some people are pretty happy with that.
Yeah, and certainly I'm one of them. And just let me be clear about this, and I'll return to this theme in a couple minutes. But the reason that I'm actually really quite happy about how Tuesday turned out, and you know, in my adult life, and obviously I was too young for 74, so my adult life is really, I think, the first time ever that an election has turned out pretty much the way I wanted it to. But the reason I'm happy is not because we have great people in power in Washington, D.C. right now. We have more people in suits and, you know, suits and ties and power suits who are in bed with corporate lobbyists and making decisions on our behalf. It really hasn't changed anything yet. It was a massive repudiation of what has gone on for the last 6 years. And that alone, the fact that people in office were held accountable, too late, obviously, for a number of the people who are dead or whose lives have been destroyed in places like Iraq and New Orleans. But nonetheless, they were held accountable. Many of them are out of power or are severely limited now in the case of the Bush administration, well, not severely limited, but certainly more limited in what they can do. But the Democrats who now control Congress still need pressure. We still need public pressure on them and pushing and organizing in order to get them to do the right thing, because we're already seeing how they're talking about the spirit of bipartisanship, and, you know, we don't want conflicts or confrontations, and impeachment is certainly off the table, and yada yada yada. Particularly at the leadership level of the Democratic Party and amongst the folks who are the front runners for their presidential nomination in 2008, you're not going to see very progressive, let alone radical, let alone, you know, politics or any kind of accountability for legally speaking for the crimes of the last 6 years of the Bush administration or the Republican Congress. So that requires that we take the energy that a lot of people put into the election this year and just redouble our efforts and make sure that the Democratic officeholders, as well as existing Democratic lawmakers like Patty Murray and Maria Cantwell, who are now in positions of greater power in D.C., that they be doing the right thing. And so, you know, that's the challenge that is now laid out before us. So folks have had their celebration this week. It's time to get back to work.
Yeah, I mean, as we were saying before, the Democrats really didn't have much of a spine prior to this election, and now they're in power, and they still are going to need those vertebrae brought to them so
yeah.
that they can.
And you know, this election, again, the Democrats weren't elected because of who they were or what they stood for. They didn't really stand for much of anything this election other than not being the Republicans. You know, the Paul Krugman in the New York Times had a great title to his column yesterday called the Great Revulsion, and that really was pretty much sums up what it was all about. This was not an endorsement of Democrats. It's that in a two-party system, primarily a two-party system, you know, the other party that's out of power is really the only tool that you have available for holding holding incompetent, corrupt, etc. Office holders accountable, and that's what was done. They were that tool, but they still need in and of themselves to prove that they're worthy of our support.
Well, and of course, the democratic process as well is more than just, you know, going to the voting box and casting your vote, and then, you know, you don't sit back
yes,
and watch
exactly.
from that point on.
Yes, because we've seen where that leaves us. Yeah. Yeah, so, but all that being said, it was a very good week, and, you know, a little bit of is definitely in order. You know, and part of what made it so sweet is that some truly obnoxious people in Washington, D.C. are now out of a job. I mean, I'm sure they'll land in cushy lobbyist positions and probably already have. But people like Richard Pombo in California, you know, the people of Pennsylvania hit a trifecta because Don Sherwood choked and Rick Santorum went to the dogs and Kurt Weldon now has plenty of time to play golf with his Serbian thug friends. You know, we had folks like George Allen embarrassing one too many voters in Virginia, probably literally one too many, and the same for Conrad Burns in Montana. We have Tom DeLay and Mark Foley's districts are now Democratic. So, you know, it was a good week for that.
I was surprised with George Allen with that race that they didn't do a recount on that because that was so close.
I was, too. I think he was under tremendous pressure, you know, the same way that Gore and Kerry were under pressure not to drag out their proceedings in 2000-2004. I think that Allen was under tremendous pressure nationally from, you know, his party and from other political leaders to wrap it up just so that the question of who controlled the Senate would be resolved. I think that was part of it. The other thing that was part of it was that there were something like 30 counties out of Virginia's, I think it's 140 once you include all the independent cities, but there are about 30 counties in Virginia, most of them rural, where they were using touchscreen voting machines for the first time, where there were a number of irregularities reported, and a lot of those favored George Allen, and I strongly suspect that a recount would have uncovered and spotlighted some of those irregularities, and they just as soon not call attention to that. So that may have been a part of it also, I don't know. But yeah, I was surprised, too. I thought this would be going on in mid-December. I really did. And I was, you know, not displeased that he did the first gracious thing that he has apparently done in his adult life. But I was certainly surprised, yeah.
Well, even irregularities locally, where which I haven't seen too much come up in the news, but at my polling place while I was voting, one of the people running the place there, I heard her say twice, "Boy, I sure hope those people whose names didn't make it on the lists raise holy hell."
Oh, dear.
Which was not a good sign while I was voting.
I have to say that I spent a fair amount of time in my polling place on Tuesday. A half hour or so, because it was a long ballot, and I was chatting with the election workers and so forth. And in that time, probably, oh, I don't know, two or three dozen people came through. It was a busy day. The turnout was tremendous. And they were each asked, do you want a touchscreen, you know, use the touchscreen, or do you want a paper ballot? Every single one chose the paper ballot. So that little unrepresentative sample says something about people in Seattle anyway. But in any event, so you had all these folks gone, and then you had at the same time, the fallout beginning. Donald Rumsfeld was forced out the door by essentially the cabal around Bush's daddy. And James Baker had his fingerprints all over this. He has an Iraq study group who's due for a report after the first of the year. He knew already going in that report would, which says that there needs to be an exit strategy from Iraq, and presumably will propose one, was going to be stonewalled by Rumsfeld, and he didn't want to issue the report until he knew it had a receptive audience. And Robert Gates is an old Bush 41 poppy friend. This is a guy who people should be worried about. This is the replacement for Rumsfeld as defense secretary. Among other things, Robert Gates, former director of the CIA under Bush 41, that is W's father, he also was implicated in a number of things earlier in his career at the CIA before he became director. He was involved, for example, with Bush Sr. in the October surprise in the fall of 1980. Where he and Bush Sr., who is the Reagan's vice presidential running mate, went to Paris to meet with Iranian clerics to negotiate a delay in release of the Iranian hostages until after the election so that Reagan could get credit for it and Carter wouldn't get a bump in the polls. That was the the popularization of the term October surprise. That's where we got it from. Gates was also helped play both sides of the fence in the Iran-Iraq war. He was actually much much more involved in selling arms, including material for chemical weapons, to Saddam Hussein than Rumsfeld was, despite Rumsfeld's photo shaking Saddam's hand. He also was involved in Iran-Contra in terms of running arms to the Contras there. He lied about all this during his confirmation hearings for CIA director in 1991. And, you know, you can just... he was also, as policy analyst director at the CIA, one of the first people really who started politicizing the intelligence analysis that came out of the CIA, which is a politicization tradition that led us to getting our misleading information on Iraq, you know, leading up to the invasion in 2003. So he's got a lot of skeletons in his closet. As a result, the current Bush W is pushing really hard to get Gates confirmed by the lame duck Congress before Christmas, because that way the Republicans still control the process. That way there'll be not enough time to investigate all of these things. And Gates is a guy who really needs to be investigated. So while you're recommitting yourself to activism, a good thing to do would be to pick up the phone and call Cantwell and Murray's offices and say, you know, do what you can proceed to get this confirmation delayed until after the new Congress is convened, because we need to air this guy out, and he's a nasty piece of work.
Yeah, he had so many skeletons in his closet, he had to, I think, move to bigger digs.
Something like that.
In fact, he is a resident of Washington State for quite a while.
Yes.
As well.
So. Yes. And, oh, speaking of closets, Ken Mailman is also out as Republican National Committee chair. One of the things that forced him out is the widespread rumors that he is another closeted gay Republican. Something about the results this week might have had something to do with it also. And then something that hasn't gotten a lot of attention yet, but Joseph Biden, who is going to be the incoming chair of the Foreign Relations Committee, is saying that in his role as chair, John Bolton, the ambassador to the UN, still actually needs to be confirmed by the Senate, because first they refused to confirm it, then Bush used a recess appointment, which is only good for a year, and then Bolton still needs to be confirmed. Well, according to Biden, that confirmation is now DOA. He is not going to move forward with it. The Democrats are not going to allow it to come to a vote, and Bush is going to have to find somebody else for the UN. So that also is going to be a casualty of the election on Tuesday. So, you know, all the way around, yeah, couldn't have happened to a less nice group of guys. On the Democratic side, John Murtha is going to be challenging Rahm Emanuel for the House Majority Leader post that Nancy Pelosi will vacate when she becomes House Speaker. Progressives actually are going to inherit quite a bit of power under the new Congress, which is actually the piece of good news that comes out of this that a lot of folks aren't focusing on in the was it a progressive wave or was it a triumph of the centrists debate, which is kind of ridiculous. Of the 21 House committees in particular, 13 of them will be chaired by people who are progressives. McDermott is not one of those. He's not in the line for any kind of committee chair, which tells you just how little influence he has in his own party after all the years he's been in office. Two of those that are in particularly interesting, that of course folks know about the Senate and House Judiciary Committees being nominated, headed by Patrick Leahy and John Conyers, respectively. Now, even though the Democratic Party leadership has said that impeachment is not on the table, that doesn't stop investigations from moving forward and subpoenas from being issued, and those happen at the committee and subcommittee levels where these guys hold sway. So that should be interesting. But also a very interesting one is the appropriations committees, because those are both now chaired by people who have been very critical of the Iraq war. David Obey in the House and Robert Byrd in the Senate. So the one way that Congress can challenge the Bush administration, which has said that it wants to keep doing what it's been doing on Iraq, is through the appropriations process. So that could get very interesting if the Democrats do indeed find a backbone. So that pretty well is at the national level what's going on. It was also very interesting to see that as a result of this, at the state level, you had quite a few changes also. The Democrats now for the first time have a majority of governorships, 28 of them, including 6 new ones as of Tuesday, and some 300 new legislators in different state houses around the country, including several pickups in Washington state, a couple of key ones on the east side where Rodney Tom and Luke Esser were both voted out in the district that probably at this point will not elect Darcy Berner. The numbers from last night were not encouraging. Up until then, I thought that Berner was going to close the gap, but it's looking like she's not going to be able to close it enough, which, you know, is too bad. She came very, very close, and hopefully she'll consider running again in 2008 if she doesn't make it this time. She still does have a chance, but I would have to say at this point it's an outside chance.
Yeah, but considering she was a complete unknown prior to that.
Yeah, and didn't really get any support from the National Democrats until she, you know, made it clear on her own that she was going to win it, or going to make it competitive, rather. And also, Berner was one of a number of cases around the country where, support from bloggers and the internet made a huge, huge difference, because they were on her bandwagon early here, and really, through their fundraising and their publicity and just giving her a forum for, you know, talking about who she is and what she wanted to do, made her candidacy viable or helped make it viable. So, that was really a testimony to how well organized the progressive blogosphere here is here in town, too. So hats off to those folks. Beyond that, there were a number of other very good things locally out of the election. Of course, 920 and 933 both going down in flames was a very useful thing. We had Susan Owens getting reelected to the state Supreme Court rather than the BIAW candidate, Steve Johnson, who is a former Republican state senator. And we had, of course, the Sonics taking a beating locally, for which they can thank the Seahawks and the Mariners and all the residual anger from, our $1 billion worth of stadia that was rammed down our throats 10 years ago. The one thing I have concern about was, on the surface, a good thing, which was the passage of the two transportation initiatives, the potholes here in Seattle and the new bus service in King County. That, combined with the complete lack of competitive races locally. Sally Clark was, except for Stan Lipman, who I voted for, was essentially effectively unopposed in her race for filling out the city council term that Jim Compton had given up. So she didn't have any opposition, really, which tells you how expensive it is to run for at-large districts in the city. And then really none of our state legislators from Seattle had any kind of opposition on Tuesday either. There were only 12, I think, that even had any opposition on the ballot, and none of those 12 incumbents got less than 2/3 of the vote, as opposed to the primary when the open seat being vacated by Ed Murray in the 43rd District House had 6 candidates, but again, nobody else had any serious competition. The upshot of those two things is that you have the state legislature in Olympia and Christine Gregoire taking away the information that, yeah, Seattle voters have deep pockets. Once again, they've proven that they're willing to tax themselves fairly heavily, plus a state congressional delegation that is completely unaccountable to voters. And the other thing that wasn't on the ballot this time was the advisory vote on what to do with the waterfront with the Alaska Way Viaduct. That was taken off the table in September when the estimate of how much a tunnel would cost went up by $1 billion, and a poll came out showing that rebuilding the viaduct would be the preferred solution. Well, the city council decided that rather than have the will of the voters being expressed, they weren't going to vote the right way, so they wouldn't be allowed to vote at all, which is, you know, kind of how we've conducted foreign policy for the last 60 years. The upshot of all of this is that when it comes to the decisions that are going to be made in the next year about what to do on the Alaska Way Viaduct, expansion of 520, expansion of Sound Transit, and the Regional Transportation Investment District vote that's supposed to come up in the next year, for all of those things, the state legislature and policymakers are likely to conclude that Seattle and King County voters can pay for all of it. Rather than the state helping out, rather than other sources helping out. And that could be a bad thing down the road. So just be aware of that danger being set up by how we voted or what we didn't get a chance to vote on Tuesday.
Hmm. The other thing that I went back and looked at least middle of the week, I don't know if the final numbers are in, but I was jazzed about, was in Pierce County, the instant runoff voting looked like it was passing.
Yes. And also statewide, there were a number of other very good initiatives as well. There are initiative outcomes. The South Dakota law banning abortions was overturned, which I think pleased a lot of people. There was an initiative allowing stem cell research in Missouri that passed. Arizona was, I think, one of the first states, if not the first state, to turn back an initiative that would have banned gay marriage. So there were a lot of different ways in which the election on Tuesday was a very positive outcome that didn't necessarily make the headlines.
And again, getting back to your original theme that people really need to start doubling, if not, you know, quadrupling or 10 times as much putting as much energy into what they've been doing is the running of third party candidates. And as you pointed out, you know, progressives did very well back in the primary, but, you know, in this election, there was just like no one to be seen, and that really needs, I think, some emphasis
and
in
not,
the coming year.
And not just third-party candidates, but also reforming the voting process itself so that third-party candidates can run viable campaigns, because so many of the rules right now are structured in a way that makes third-party candidacies very, very difficult to run and to sustain. So things like instant runoff voting, proportional representation, changing the primary system that we have right now, which doesn't allow voters to even consider third-party candidates until November. The debate rules that usually shut out third-party candidates, you know, all these things all the way up and down the line have been determined over the years by legislators and by the state parties themselves. And that's simply got to change. It's got to become a more open process. Otherwise, you're never going to have real variety on the ballot. And to get back to the original point, it's not just the ballot. It's also about community organizing and building a movement, which has already happened to some degree, the expression of which happened on Tuesday, but that's not the movement itself. The movement itself happens between elections, happens at the community level, happens when people get out, get involved, and get organized. And that's what we need to do more than ever right now.
Very good. All right. Moving along, Aaron Watata.
To the surprise of absolutely nobody, the base commander at Fort Lewis has made a decision in the Aaron Watata case, that being Lieutenant General James Dubik. He has agreed to go forward with the Watata prosecution in a court-martial. He did drop one of the charges against Aaron, that being the charge of conduct unbecoming an officer. That's still in. It was the charge of contempt toward officials that was dropped. But most of those charges are going forward. That court-martial will happen sometime after the first of the year.
Okay. And jumping to national sleaze of the week.
This was a UN audit report that came out. Oh, by the way, on the election, I did mean to throw this in. My favorite quote came in an objective Washington Post article about this, talking about the reaction around the world to the election, which I didn't touch on before. Quote, the seismic political shift in the United States was greeted in many places around the world with jubilation. That was more a sense of relief that Americans had at long last come to their senses, end quote. So there you go. Sleaze of the Week. A UN audit report came out this week looking at some of the overcharging that Halliburton had done to the government of Iraq, and it had some real eye-openers. For example, as much as $25,000 per month was charged for each of as many as 1,800 fuel trucks that were used to deliver gasoline in Iraq after the 2003 invasion, but the trucks often spent days or weeks sitting idle at the border. In other words, they weren't being used at all, but I don't know, 1,800 by 25,000, I haven't done that math, but it sounds like a lot of money. Also, the Kuwaiti government had set the price of its gasoline at $1.13 a gallon, but with the delivery charges, the effective cost of the gas to the Iraq government was calculated by Halliburton to be much higher, about $8 a gallon. So, you know, nice market if you can get it. And the reason this is in Sleaze of the Week, of course, is that our Vice President, Dick Cheney, Halliburton is his old company, and he still has some interest in Halliburton. So even if he's destroyed the country of Iraq, at least he's making a nice, tidy profit for himself.
All right. Jumping quickly to international, Iraq.
Yeah, Saddam Hussein, of course, found guilty this week in a process that was controlled start to end by the United States. In all probability, an illegal trial, almost any way that you cut it. And, of course, the timing of his announcement of his sentencing very much had to do with the U.S. elections. If you have any doubt of this, look at the fact that the verdict itself, I don't think it's actually the written verdict come out yet. It was supposed to come out 2 days ago on Thursday. But when was the last time you heard of a sentence being issued before the verdict had been reached? Meanwhile, al-Maliki, the prime minister, is saying that even with the appeals process, that execution should happen within a month. So they want to get this done and over with, and presumably the bloody outburst of chaos that Iraq will be plunged into over with as quickly as they can before Saddam can start talking about who exactly was arming him, like Robert Gates. The other thing that that came out this week was a report in CNN that a series of secret U.S. war games in 1999 showed that an invasion and post-war administration of Iraq would require 400,000 troops, and those games showed also that the country still had a significant chance of dissolving into chaos. So this was all stuff that was known even before the Bush administration, and yet they chose to go ahead and plunge in anyway.
All right, and quickly, Pakistan?
Yeah, we talked last week about the U.S. airstrike that killed 80 students at a school in northwest Pakistan. Well, this week there was a suicide bombing, didn't get much attention here, but it killed 43 people at the main army training base in Pakistan. So that country looks like it's going to get more violent as a result of the U.S. Global War on Terror also.
All right, and finally, Israel.
Yeah, Prime Minister Emir is going to be at the White House tomorrow talking about what Israel always talks about when they're come hat in hand to the U.S., namely more military assistance, I'm sure, and also possibility of launching an attack on Iran. We had the Deputy Defense Minister saying this week that an attack on Iran by Israel, quote, might be necessary. So watch out for that. And, of course, Israel also stepped up its air raids on Gaza this week and killed even more Palestinians than usual. But that, again, also didn't really make much news.
All right. Talking as we do every week with Jav Parrish, co-editor at Eat This State, and tell people where they can find you at
Eat
This State.
Eat This State is a volunteer publication. Comes out every couple of weeks. We have a new issue out this week, in fact. It's also available on the web at www.eatthestate.org. We are in the midst of our annual fund drive. We don't pay for office or staff. What we do pay for is printing and postage, and that's about it. So if you value this kind of information, we would very much appreciate your donations, or buy a t-shirt or gift subscriptions for the upcoming holidays, any of that good stuff. You can do it online at eatthestate.org or P.O. Box 85541, Seattle 98145, or you can come to our 10th anniversary party. It is happening tomorrow afternoon. Also happens to be my birthday, which I swear is a coincidence, and I don't really like birthday parties, but here we go. It is 4 to 6 p.m. at the Asteroid Cafe in Fremont, 36th and Fremont Avenue North, specifically 3601 Fremont, and it's in the second Suite 207, the old Red Apple building. So Asteroid Cafe, 4 o'clock tomorrow. There will be hors d'oeuvres. It's all free. Come hang out. Celebrate 10-plus years of fine alternative journalism and commentary and humor, and just come by, say hi. We'd be happy to see you. 4 to 6, Asteroid Cafe, tomorrow afternoon.